All right, guys. Jaime and Liam back with you again today for episode 3 of our Sports Physio podcast. Today, we're going to be talking about strength training and kind of going beyond strength. What are some of the qualities or things we need to be thinking about, especially when rehabbing athletes, beyond just pure basic strength training?
This is huge, man. I'm excited about this.
Absolutely. So I think let's dive in, man. I think this is going to be a good one. We got a lot of thoughts on this, and I'm excited to see where we go with this. Did you want to start with kind of a strength overview?
Yeah, let's go for it. You, seem like you had the better grasp on this right now. So let's have you describe this to the people.
So guys, before we get past, past strength, I think it is important to hammer down on strength a little bit. And here's when we say, like, this conversation we're about to have is not, it's not taking away the importance of strength training or like maximal strength training or like working to get people strong. I think that's super important, and that's kind of the foundation. And when we say, like, I wanted to define some terms too, so we can really like speak in specifics with this. But when we say strength or strength training, like, really we're talking about the ability to overcome or counteract external resistance by muscular effort. Right. Okay. So that's the definition that we're gonna use for this. So this is your athlete doing your one rep max squat or bench press or any exercise where they're doing it. It's the maximum amount of force that they can achieve. Good with that definition, Liam?
That sounds good to me. That sounds pretty literal right there. Let's do it.
So I think one mistake that happens with this a lot is you do need to make sure that you achieve maximal strength. And if an athlete has really low levels of maximal strength, and that's definitely going to be something that you want to work on. When we get into power later, what you're going to see is if you have really low levels of strength, your ability to produce high levels of power is going to be really limited, right? Because there's dependence, interdependence between the two. So think about the easy example for this is like picture you have two people, okay? So one person can squat 200 pounds and the other athlete can squat 100 pounds. If I give each of them 50 pounds and tell them to squat as quickly as they can, it's likely in that scenario that the person that can squat, let's use 75 pounds to make this a little bit better example. In that scenario, I'm gonna bet a lot of money that the guy that can squat 200 pounds is gonna be able to squat more quickly just because it's such a relatively lighter load for him versus the guy that can squat 100. That's 75% of his one rep max. I think the issue with this becomes when, once you've achieved good strength levels, it's really important, especially if that athlete is doing something fast, explosive, or dynamic where there's going to be high velocities, to kind of transition into working more on maybe like power and speed in the weight room.
Yeah, I feel like, after someone tears an ACL, we keep hearing, hammer strength, 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 so we kind of forget about the power and speed components as well. So I'm glad we're diving into this stuff right now.
Yeah, so I think that's the take home for this, guys, is like, don't ignore the strength stuff, but we want to really give you maybe give you some ideas or just kind of discuss why it's so important to get into the power and speed portion of this. So I think one thing that if we're talking about power, like basically if we were to look at it from a physics standpoint, it's a measure of work produced in a specific unit of time, right? So power is equal to force multiplied by velocity. So velocity being how fast you're moving, force being the amount of strength essentially, right? So working on either of those can improve your power output. And this is where, again, it comes back to, I think as a clinician, you really need to do a good thorough assessment and see where the deficit is, right? Because if you have really low force, that's going to be an issue. If you have really low velocity, that's going to be an issue as well. I think, Liam, you had mentioned a study too with ACL rehab that talked a little bit about rate of force development. Do you want to summarize that for us real quick?
Yeah, I think we mentioned that in a previous podcast. We talked about how after tearing an ACL, people return their strength. I think it might be right here too. But it's right here. They return to their about 79% similar strength values of their other limb at about 6 months. No, I totally just said that wrong. At 6 months, they had about 96% strength of the other limb, but 79% rate of force development. So I don't know exactly, I can't remember exactly what they were looking at here, because that 96% strength of their opposite limb seems like it's a little high, but just the point they're making is, yeah, they may have the same, pretty similar strength, but when you look at rate of force development, it's a pretty huge gap, and we're talking about rate of force development, we're talking about doing anything athletic right now, so that's pretty significant.
So in that study, those athletes, like, right, like if we're rehabbing that athlete in 6 months and they're maybe they're practicing or they're getting close, you're in the final, you know, let's say we're working off that 9 month timeline or thereabouts, you know, they're on the home stretch in terms of, you're going to really need to place an emphasis on restoring them to like sport specific movements. So if it's an American football player and they're a wide receiver, really fast running and cutting, right, in multiple planes, directions, under fatigue. So in that study, they had strength, like if I'm the therapist, I'm coming in and I'm assessing this athlete and I'm looking at my little power equation, power is equal to force times velocity, force, check, boom, they did a great job. Like, that was fantastic job restoring the strength. Now the velocity component is something that we're going to need to kind of really need to dive into. And I don't want to like belabor the point too much, but I do think I've got a Zatsiorsky Science and Practice of Strength Training in front of me. So this is like, if you're in the field of strength and conditioning, you've heard of or read this book. It's really like foundational text, I guess, for some of the basic concepts. But I love some of the discussion in here. And like, with my background in baseball, this is something that I think is super important with that. But the thing that you got to remember is, most of the knowledge that we have or the background that we have with strength training comes from usually from either powerlifting or Olympic weightlifting. So sports where the goal is maximal force development, right? So like all of those like training methodologies and systems are designed to, you win the competition by lifting the most weight, by being the strongest person, right? Which if you're a team sport athlete, there's no team sport that I'm familiar with or even like individual sport, really, like any field sport, any court sport, any sport with a ball, where you win by being the strongest, right? So strength is a portion of that. It's an element of that, but there's a ton of, again, if we go back to that wide receiver example, if we go to the NFL combine and we looked at like career Pro Bowl appearances versus like strength levels, I'd be willing to bet a lot of money, and I haven't done this, but there's probably no correlation between, especially amongst that level of receivers, strength and ability to perform at the highest level. So it's a quality you need, but it's not the quality that you need. Does that make sense?
Yeah, because also I'm thinking, you know, these lifts, like a snatch, it's in one plane pretty much. So, you know, these sports are played in, you know, outside of just that one movement.
Great point. No, that's awesome. So, I wanted to read you guys a couple other quotes here from Zatsiorsky that I think will make a lot of sense with this. So basically, like the ability to produce maximal force, i.e. muscular strength, and the ability to achieve great velocity in the same motion are different motor abilities. So what he's saying here is, you know, doing that heavy one rep max squat pattern is not necessarily going to improve, let's say like your vertical jump or something where you're loading in that same pattern. So to me, this is that argument where people sometimes talk about like the specificity of the weight room. What that's saying right there is, and Liam, tell me if you disagree, but to me, I don't view the weight room or strength training as specific really at all, because we know if that's a wide receiver and they're going to run at 10 meters per second or, you know, 20 miles per hour, however fast they're running, it's way faster than any movement that they're going to do. So I don't like, one thing I really like disagree with is when people are choosing all these exercises because they're so much more specific, because the velocity between the weight room and the field is going to be so different that like however similar the motion looks, like people will be like, oh, I'm in this lunge because it looks like I'm running, blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. It's so much slower. And like based on that quote, you're going to see you're not going to develop those same biomotor abilities. Do you have any thoughts on that?
You know, just kind of what we were talking about a little earlier before this podcast about, you know, adding in resistance or assistance to, you know, facilitate that similar velocities or, you know, movement patterns too. But no, that's pretty much, I'm on the same page there with you.
Yeah. So last thing I wanted to give you guys kind of from this text too is like, he's got a great, I'm just going to read straight from it, quote, because he's got a great example in here for you guys. So he's talking about, So elite shot putters spend 50% of their total training time on heavy resistance training. World-class javelin throwers spend only 15 to 25% of their total training time in the weight room. Why is this? The implement weights are so different. So a shot put weighs about 7.2 kilos for men, 4 kilos for women. So it's really heavy, right? It's 15 pounds, almost 10 pounds. Javelins weigh 0.8 and 0.6 kilos. So the men's javelin's about 1 pound. For top athletes, the velocity of a shot put at release is about 14 meters per second, versus the javelin throwers are thrown at 30 meters per second. So these values correspond to different parts of that force velocity curve. The shot putters are going to need really high maximal strength levels because there's a high correlation between maximal strength and the velocity of movement because the movement's slow. The correlation is low in javelin throwing because it's much faster. And if you think again, so like he says in here, it'd be much smaller for a table tennis stroke since the paddle's very light. I think for me, this goes to, I think about like a baseball player. If you're throwing a 5 ounce baseball, you know, there's very little correlation there between your 300 pound bench press and the and you throwing that ball, just because there's such a big difference in that force velocity curve. And this is something that I think if you're a therapist or strength coach, if you work with athletes that play most of the big sports here in America, football, soccer, baseball, basketball, like the one thing those all have in common is they achieve like really high velocities. So you need to be pretty well versed in that concept and be comfortable with kind of, once you've built that strength, like that study did where they, okay, we got almost 100% full strength, but we still have a deficit in rate of force development. This is where we got to really transition to working on power. So, hopefully that was helpful and kind of like just the theoretical framework of kind of why we're doing this and what the importance is for this. And I think the thing to remember here too is the faster the movement that you're trying to get them to, the more emphasis needs to be placed on power training or that velocity work. So if you're a left tackle in football, you might spend more time on that maximal strength because the relative velocity of your sport-specific skill is going to be lower, and there is going to be a really high muscular force component. I'm going to need to move another large human. If I am a, like, let's say I'm a outside receiver and, like, my game is, like, being a vertical threat, right? You're going to need to spend less time on the maximal strength department and way more time on the maximal velocity or power side of things. So maybe, Liam, let me know what you think, but I think from here, maybe we go towards... What are some of the, like when you think power in the weight room, what does that mean to you? What are you thinking about?
Before I dive down there, I wanted to just bring up a point of what you were just talking about. I think we, as therapists, get excited about once we get this athlete in here, you know, we hear how much of like after an ACL tear, how important it is to get the quad strength back. And, you know, if you even have access to the heavy equipment to load them, you know, that seems to be rare too, but okay, even if you have access to this heavy equipment, I think we get so fixated on building strength. But just from what you're talking about, it sounds like there's a ceiling of strength that we really need. You know, we don't just want to keep loading up as heavy as we can every single time these athletes come in. We want to make sure that we're moving at a faster rate too. And it seems like that's what we're delving into now, not just the strength stuff, but now we're transitioning into talking more about power.
I got a question for you, Liam, and I don't know if you have an answer for this, but
probably not. Let's go.
How do we know when an athlete is like was strong enough?
Yeah.
What are your thoughts on that?
Man, I was just about to ask you that question. So, I don't know, man. I don't know if there's no specific test that I know is out there to say, you know, compared is it a ratio up to their body mass, how high they could jump. Is it a hop test that's going to tell us that, or is it really just a force velocity curve? So I can't tell you. It's this percent. Is it a certain body weight percentage high? Man,
I think so. One of the things. So I agree with you. Like there's no like good testing out there, and even those tests that you mentioned, like those are going to have a really big velocity component. So there, it's going to be tough to tell if you're trying to determine if they're strong enough. I think anything that's kind of plyometric, hopping, jumping, is going to be difficult because it's not going to be a pure measure of maximal strength. The one that I've seen in the literature before is referenced as a ratio of like maximal strength in a back squat activity to body weight. So 2 times body weight being like kind of max. You have an appropriate amount of maximal strength. I would say like anecdotally in my experience, like 1.75 times body weight anywhere from 1.5 to 2.0 seems to be a pretty good ratio. And I think it is, like, I do want to make the point, if you're working with a 15-year-old high school basketball player, the likelihood that they have a 2x body weight back squat, and this is a legit back squat to parallel with good form, it's pretty low. So, like, there are a lot of, like, that's low hanging fruit in terms of really improving the strength there. But I think when you do see this, and probably the best answer for this is it's clinical expertise, right? Like, when you've worked with athletes and you're watching them move, you're seeing how they handle load, and then also how quickly they're able to move, you can kind of get a sense of what traits or adaptations they might need more of. But the point is, once they've achieved that strength level, let's call it 1.75x body weight on a back squat. So if you're a 100-pound athlete, you're able to squat 175 pounds. Once they've achieved that, that's when you really need to start transitioning over to that power work, because if you continue to work on maximal strength, you're not going to get carryover. You're going to end up like that study where you've got good strength levels, but the rate of force development is still really diminished.
And that seems like a realistic thing we can do in the clinic, you know, testing a back squat if you have enough weight, because, you know, I don't know many clinics that have those machines where you can track how much force they're actually, like, performing during a leg press or a knee extension too.
Yeah. And this brings up, yeah, I think those Biodex machines are cool, but obviously that's something that outside of a research setting, it's not a lot of us have access to. But look, Liam, I want to get your thoughts on this, but I think just like as we're talking through that too, the thought that comes to mind with me is like, man, these kids are getting like cleared to cut, run, jump, do all this stuff. And do we even know, like, did we even like test their strength? Like, do we know that they achieved like those maximal strength levels? Like, I feel like if you're a therapist and if you're handing off to a strength and conditioning or sport performance coach, then that's fine. And it might not be something where you need to like really like restore that. Like, I'm thinking, I feel like a pretty common thing is like, you'll maybe rehab them for the first 3 months and then they'll kind of get discharged with the thought that there's more rehab to come, but now this is going to, now they can lift weights at their high school program. They can do all that stuff and they're going to work on that strength. But if you're handling kind of that first 6 month period, as a therapist, you need to be comfortable and you need to make sure that you are like fully restoring the strength and exposing these guys to those really high loads.
Are we going to add a 2x body weight back squat to our ACL protocol? I haven't seen any of that in any of these protocols out there. I feel like that's pretty cool. Not to say 2x body weight needs to be it. Maybe it's 1.75. Maybe it's something like that. Yeah. But that's interesting. I've never seen that involved in any single protocol.
And that's funny, because like, if we look at the that's really interesting to me. Just thinking about, right, because if we're on that power, we know that force plays a component in power, and to me really like, sports is about power. Like, when we talk about team sports in America, power is the key, right? It's not about how much force you can express. It's about how much force you can express, how quickly you can. And think about it like this. Like, we know that maximal force can take up to 6 to 8 seconds. If you've ever seen a like world record attempt, like back squat or bench press, and they're shaking and struggling, or a deadlift, and they got the earthquake going, those will take like upwards of 5 seconds. There's very few plays in American sport that take, think about a basketball player driving to the hoop. It's like 2 seconds or less, a second or less, right? Definitely like a baseball player, like throwing a baseball, or even a football player running a route, like they're not going to run a 7 second route for the most part. So yeah, again, I just think like just think critically about this stuff. I think that's kind of a theme that we've been going over. We talked a lot with you, like analyzing some of the movements and just like literally watching these wide receivers and seeing what the positions they get into. I feel like there's not enough of that where critically analyze it and see like, okay, what are the demands of their sport? And then how do we reverse engineer that? But I do think it would be, to your point, adding some sort of like maximal strength measure like that would be really cool. And I think it probably doesn't get added because it's might be more difficult. Like, you have that element of like skill proficiency, equipment limitations, and then you, on a Biodex, it's easy to standardize like, you know, concentric quad strength as I'm extending the knee, versus like the back squats. Like, well, did they squat 6 inches high? Did they blah, 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 blah. But I think just keeping that in mind that you do need to establish that maximal strength for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. Are we transitioning into a little bit of power?
I think now? So, man. Let's get into it. What, What comes to mind for you when you think of power? Where are you going with that?
Well, what's the author of this book right here?
Zatziorski.
Zatziorski really hit it.
Vladimir.
Sound pretty good with the you know you're moving something heavy and you're moving something pretty fast too.
Yeah.
Well, you know, not, I guess I pull that back a little bit. Not necessarily really really heavy, because if it's too heavy, you can't move it very fast. So there's a balance between those.
That right there. I'm glad you said that, because I think that's so important with this guy. So again, I'm not trying to beat you over the brow with this book, but straight out of Zatziorski, it may seem surprising that the greatest power value is that of velocity 1/3 the value of maximal velocity. One should not forget, however, that in the simplest case, power equals force multiplied by velocity. Okay, so the take-home point here is power level is going to be way greater with a relatively lighter load than with a heavier load, okay? And if we get into the context of the sports, again, remember, they're going to be situations of really high power output because the velocity is so great. So you need to really be okay with using some lighter weights at times with the intent and the emphasis on moving really, really quickly. And you got to really, really coach that, really, really cue that, because most athletes are not used to moving that fast in the weight room.
Yeah, so it sounds like you can't just give them a really, really heavy weight and say, okay, move as fast as you can and expect to make those adaptations you're looking for that are going to, you know, help them move more powerfully when they're playing their sport.
Yeah.
So you got to drop the weight a little bit, man. Luckily, I only work out with light weights because that's all I can pick up.
Likewise. We like it. So, yeah. So, okay. So when we talk power in the context of the weight room, and when I say weight room, like, guys, I'm just picturing like your clinic, right? You probably don't have access to a full size like football field or soccer field in your clinic or a track. So what are some of the things you can do? I think for sure, like the plyometrics are going to be great here, right? This is going to really target the rate of force development. It's going to be a lot lighter loading, so you're going to be able to achieve much higher velocities with that. So like a really comprehensive and extensive plyometric program is going to be huge. Obviously doing things like more like dynamic effort, you know, squats, deadlifts. Like we talked to, I think Liam and I are both like huge fans of doing some single leg, like really emphasizing the single leg work. So I'll do a lot of those things where maybe it's a rear foot elevated split squat, but now the intent is we're moving for speed or velocity. We're trying to see how quickly we can go. Those are kind of like the big building blocks for me in terms of how we're going to address power. So like the plyometrics, and then using really light loads. And I'm talking like less than 50% of your one rep max, 30 to 50% of your one rep max, in the weight room. And then obviously we talked kind of hit on this in a previous podcast, but the, like any speed work or like agility stuff that you're doing, that's going to be huge. That's power training.
Yeah, and that just kind of takes me back to, you know, we can't just, you know, you can't just go training strength and then expect these people to perform these powerful movements or these plyometric movements. I mean, you want to build up to that using things like non-counter movement, you know, counter movement jumps. You can't just expect the athlete to be able to perform these movements because you got this person super strong. Like, just because someone's strong, there's this, like, quick elastic component that we want to it's a different stress on these tissues.
I think that's a really good perspective, and I think that's something we got to really really keep in mind. I mean, what we're saying here, guys, like over and over, is it's a blend, right? It's like when you're rehabbing this stuff, it's like making a it's like cooking a meal. You need to have the right ratio of all your spices and seasonings. Each of them has a specific and different role and is important. Depending on the dish or the flavor that you're trying to create, you might need to manipulate that ratio, or you might need to add and subtract. It's the same thing with this. So like, there's no hard and fast rules for a lot of these things, but you got, you know, just like a really accomplished chef, you got to kind of use your clinical skill set to see like, okay, this guy's going to need a little bit more elasticity. Oh, wow, he does have really low maximal strength levels. We need to really load up on that. That's going to be what makes this dish successful. So Yeah, take-home point for that is making sure that you have emphasis on moving at high speeds. And this, to me, this needs to happen before, like, before you're on the field doing sport-specific drills and cutting and, like, exposing them to those velocities. They need to be exposed to the velocities in the weight room. And I think this is where maybe the schooling kind of, like, sets us up for failure a little bit. But most of the time, at least for me, when I was in PT school, like, emphasis is like slow and controlled movement with like, right? Like super slow, super controlled. Like it's safer. We have a chance to cue form. Did you find you kind of had like a similar experience with that?
Yeah. Yeah. I don't remember talking about, you know, adding an elastic band to, I don't know, put on the trap bar, the squat, just to improve a little more power or anything like that. I would love I wish there was an elective like that.
Yeah.
At the school I went to.
That would be, that'd be really cool. But yeah, so, I mean, you got to get outside of that framework. And I think if you're not, guys, if we know they're going to run, okay, and I don't know the exact, I can't remember in exact meters per second what a top velocity would be, but these guys are a high school athlete, right? Like they're going to run in the high teens, like maybe even to the 20s in terms of miles per hour. So if we correlate that to meters per second in the weight room stuff is slow. It's really slow compared to running. So We've said this before, but I think it's crazy when people haven't moved fast in the weight room. They haven't done like dynamic effort, like squats or jumps or like really, really. And I'm not talking about like your 6-inch box. Like there's different jumping, right? Like I can do a 6-inch hop to a box for proprioception and motor control. And that has a place. And like, and you and I both do that stuff, but that's not the same as, you know, a repeat depth drop where I'm exploding up and I'm coming out of this box, I'm coming off and then I'm redirecting force. Like those are two different things and they're training different qualities. And I think there's a lot of like, I see a lot of like I'm doing the air quotes, plyometrics where it's these like more motor control ones where it's really low amplitude, like pretty low velocity jumping. And there's a lot of, you're really like, it has long ground contact times and you're stabilizing. Or I know some protocols I've seen have like, you know, the line hops back and forth, back and forth. But in that case, like the rate of force development is fairly high, but the ground contact forces are so low. Like that's nothing. Me standing there on both feet or even on one leg and hopping back and forth over a line 4 inches, that's not going to prepare me for sprinting and cutting off that leg. Like the forces are just totally different, guys. So if you feel comfortable, and this is something that really drives me nuts, you should not be clearing athletes to sprint and cut on a field if you haven't seen them do similar things in the weight room. Because the weight room, we just said, it's gonna be way slower. It's a controlled environment. They should be doing exactly what you tell them to do. There's no element of kind of reactivity or unpredictability with it. If you're not doing that stuff there, then why are they being cleared to get out on the field and do all that? So that just got on the soapbox there for a little bit of a rant, but something to really be thinking about and paying attention to.
Yeah, that's a great point. The most value I see out of those little like side hop things or an agility ladder is just building confidence in the...
Great point.
Yeah, just building confidence in the leg, or like if it's, you know, someone who tore their ACL, just getting comfortable moving in different planes, moving at a little faster rates. But yeah, it's not going to replicate the forces that we want when they get back to sport.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Did you want to go into maybe like kind of structuring and like how do we, like what does it look like to put together kind of a rehab protocol or training session for some of these athletes, or was there more on on power that you want to get into?
I wanted to mention like the band things, adding I just want to touch on a few other ways we can train power in the clinic.
Yeah,
if it might be some may be a little fancier ways to do it, but yeah, I love the thought of adding, well, what are your thoughts on, you know, if we have a barbell back squat and we add a band, let's say assistance, where the band's coming from above, maybe, I don't know, we're talking 5% of the clinics actually have an environment where this is possible, but I see value in it. You know, putting some bands in a way where it's going to help you at the bottom of the squat, just to help you explode up a little faster. Do you find any value in things like that?
Yeah, absolutely. So if you guys aren't familiar, what Liam's kind of talking about here is using what we call accommodating resistance. So if you look at, let's talk about a back squat, for example. In a back squat, you're going to be weakest at the bottom, strongest at the top, right? And if that's confusing, just think about it. if I have you do a little quarter squat, right? The people we make fun of at the gym, they're doing like the little tiny knee bend versus squatting really, really low. You're going to be able to use a lot more weight in that quarter squat. So what happens sometimes is there's a natural tendency to decelerate as you're coming up out of the bottom, right? So you're overcoming the maximum amount of force at the bottom of the squat, and then it gets easier as I come up to the top. So you're naturally going to slow down. And if you didn't, again, if that's confusing, think about it. If you stop at the top, right? So if you didn't slow down, like that bar would just keep accelerating, you'd keep jumping out. One thing you can do is you could change that. You can change that kind of force velocity curve by doing resistance with bands. So on a back squat, having bands around each end of the barbell and then anchored down to the squat rack, heavy dumbbell, anything. There's a million different ways to set it up. So now those bands are not stretched as much at the bottom. Okay, so it's just the bar weight. But then as you come out of the hole where you're getting stronger because you have more of a mechanical advantage, and normally you'd be slowing down a little bit, the band is now stretching. So it's effectively making that weight heavier, allowing you to continue accelerating into the bar. Okay, so in that case, you could use bands, you could use chains as well as another good way to do it. I do find value in that. I think, again, you need to establish that if you don't have good maximal strength levels, you're not going to get as much out of that exercise. But this is for the athlete that you've achieved good maximal strength. I don't tend to do a lot of the assisted work. So in that would be like resisted. Assisted would just be the opposite, right? So I could have anchored from the ceiling or like the top of a high squat rack bands. So basically now at the bottom, it's going to assist me out of there. So I'm going to be able to overload the movement. I find that helpful if you have athletes that are struggling with confidence, or maybe you really want to expose them to really high loads. That's a good way to get them, because you can get them in the hole of a back squat and basically deload that bar, but eccentrically they're still going to have to slow it down. But in that case, they're going to slow down a lot coming out of the hole. So the velocity isn't going to be necessarily as high. What I do really like with that, and I think is not too fancy or a difficult setup, is using assisted plyometrics. So picture, and I know I've seen you do this, we've talked about this before, but like throwing that jump stretch band over the top of a squat rack, athletes can pull down on it. So there's a force pulling them up. So think of like how you have a band set up for an assisted pull up, guys. And now they can do vertical jumps, or they can do split squat jumps. So that band is actually going to help pull them out of it. I love that. That's a really good way to start to expose them to higher velocities. It's going to allow athletes to, just achieve a higher velocity than they could normally without it. So chains, bands and chains are both really good implements. I like the assisted plyometrics, but I think, guys, the point here too is you don't need to have, if you don't have bands or chains, just put 50% of their body weight on the bar and have them move quickly. Okay. You can, and there's different ways you can do this. You can do time sets. You can be there with a stopwatch. Okay. We're going to do 3 reps in 3 seconds. Boom, go. And that's an easy way to make sure that they're quantifying it. They make devices like you could obviously, like there's something like a Tendo unit, which, you know, most rehab clinics aren't going to have, but that would attach to the bar and give you a readout meters per second. I've used in the past a device called the Push Band. It's kind of like it looks like a little sweatband, and it links with Bluetooth to your phone and it gives you a readout. So, okay, that squat was 0.8 meters per second. Again, that's a good tool. I don't think it's necessarily like super necessary. I think if you're good with your coach's eye, you're going to be able to just kind of get a lot of these things just from watching and paying attention. But those are some really good methods for sure for power.
If you just drop some knowledge on these people, man, and myself. Dude, here's a fun little question. If you you're at a clinic, maybe with the same population we see right now, we see a lot of athletes, mostly football, soccer, I'd say, and you can only get one bar, whether it be a safety barbell or a hex bar. You can only like afford one at this point in time.
Do I have a regular barbell as well? Or this is my, I'm only getting one.
You only get one. You get a barbell, safety, or a trap bar.
This is a tough one. I probably, I think I'd probably go regular barbell, just because I'm going to want to use that regular barbell for like landmine pressing, maybe like rows, like upper body stuff as well. Mm-hmm. You know, things like RDLs as well. If I already have enough stuff to train upper body with, then I think I'm probably going to get into that trap bar. I mean, I love, like, this is a, this is like asking me to pick between Lucky Charms and Captain Crunch Crunch Berries. Like, there's no right answer here. It's a, like, we want them both, Liam. We want both of those in our pantry.
You do. Touche.
But yeah, I think in that case, I'd probably go regular barbell just for the versatility of it.
Yeah, totally. I love that adaptability of both. I just love how the trap bar, you know, you can turn it into a little more of a squat or a little more of a deadlift or a squat or a hinge movement.
If you're rehabbing athletes, if you're working with anyone that isn't a Olympic weightlifter or powerlifter, I mean, I'm going trap bar, hex bar, all the way. It's just it makes so much more sense. Like, you eliminate some of that learning curve. The first time people are learning a deadlift with a straight bar, it's kind of awkward. Like, the center of mass is positioned in front of you, right? The whole goal is to keep that center of mass through, like, kind of through the midfoot. The position of the bar, like, naturally discourages that. So they talk about, like, setting people up for failure.
Yeah.
It kind of puts it there right away. So, I mean, if they don't need to do that for their sport, or maybe, like, a competitive CrossFit athlete that needs to have that that skill proficiency. But if you're a football player, there's no reason you need to straight bar deadlift necessarily. I love that trap bar. Just like you said, it's way more comfortable, way easier, way less awkward for people to pick up. And again, using your clinical skill set, if you've got someone that is lacking a little bit of quad strength, you can cue them into a little bit more knee forward position, loaded at the bottom. If you really want to emphasize posterior chain, let's say it's a tall, skinny high school volleyball player who loves to collapse forward, you can make it more of like a high hip posterior chain dominant deadlift really easily. You got the high handles, so you can flip it up and put people into a better position, which again, guys, like, just a sidebar rant here, like, the diameter of a plate isn't custom to the person. Okay. So especially if you're working with athletes, you're going to see some crazy body types. Don't be afraid to elevate that deadlift, right? Like, you can get it up higher. So they're not, it's not, you know, a third of the way from off the ground on their tibia. If you're 6'3" with really long femurs, you may need to elevate it on bumper plates or like safety pins and racks. Just find the right height for that patient or that client. Don't just do whatever's arbitrarily there because of the diameter of the plate. Totally.
That reminds me, I picked this idea up from an Exos program where they kind of mentioned that, you kind of even talked about it before, just how we're so used to training in a way of whether it be like Olympic style lifting or even like bodybuilding. Mm-hmm. So it's, and you know, when you go to the gym, you see so many people picking up the bar off the ground when it's like, okay, yeah, that's cool. You're moving through a very large range of motion, but there's so much value in, you know, what's the purpose behind why you're doing it? Well, when I'm doing a cut or something like that, I'm not cutting with my butt all the way to the floor. I'm in a pretty athletic position. Yeah. So
that's what I love about the trap bar too. I feel like it really puts you into, like, if I was to like verbally describe, and we talked about this in maybe one or two podcasts ago, I can't remember, with like teaching athletic position. Right. And it's framework, guys, in context. Like, if this is a young, like, developmental age athlete and you taught them athletic position, the trap bar is awesome for that, because now, like, when they get in position to deadlift there, it's going to be athletic position, right? Feet are going to be underneath their hips, knees are flexed, butt is back, chest is like slightly forward. It should look like, for my baseball players, like, I tell them, okay, you're at shortstop, you're getting ready to field the pitch or field the, make the next play, basically. So yeah, I think I love that position, and there's a lot of carryover there for sure.
Let's just mosey on over to the next idea. We're talking about developing and structuring a program. Mm. Tell me what some things are coming to your mind right now.
Well, maybe so like general rules of thumb for this, and we talked about this a little bit in terms of when you would want to do like the agility training. Or change of direction work with athletes within the context of a session. But if I have a session, let's say I have 60 minutes, I want to structure the order of movements that we're going to do in sequence based on the amount of demand on their nervous system. So more explosive to less explosive is an easy way to think about it. So within that 60 minutes, we're probably going to spend the first 10 minutes doing some sort of warm-up movement prep. Guys, there's a million different options here. I'm sure you guys are all familiar with this, but the goals of this, obviously, elevate core body temperature. I want I want athletes, they should be sweating by the time that their heart rate should be elevated a little bit, and they should be sweating. This is one where, especially with young athletes, like most of the time they have no idea how to warm up properly. So I'll normally use I like to do a variety of kind of like ground-based mobility drills, and then get kind of from there progress up onto our feet into maybe some like activation stuff, maybe some lateral band walk and different things like that to get some muscles firing. And then the last part of that kind of warm-up phase would be some faster movements. Okay, so if they've progressed to the point where they are like doing more movement-based stuff, this is a good time to do some of your movement skills, shuffling, crossover, blah, 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 all that stuff. From there, the next thing we want to go into right away is going to be the highest demand on the nervous system. So if you have either any type of like sprinting or like change of direction agility work planned for that day, it should come here. Unless the only caveat would be that you're purposely trying to expose them to that under a fatigue situation, which should come later once they've demonstrated mastery. Okay, so I did 10 minutes on my warm up, and this stuff doesn't, guys, it doesn't need to be, excuse me, really long or drawn out here. This next portion would be probably, I like 15, maybe 20 minutes that I'm going to spend on, let's call it like our movement skills. Okay. It's still a term from Exos, whatever that might be for the day. Okay. So now I'm 25, 30 minutes into the workout. I got about half my time left. Now I'm going to progress over into more like the weight room side of things. If I'm going to be doing some power work that day, this is when it should happen. It should happen first. So if it's plyometrics, I'm going to do my plyometrics here. If I'm working like some dynamic effort, like squatting or deadlifting or single leg variations, that should happen here. But generally it's going to be more sets. So I'm thinking like four to eight sets here for reps, maybe 2 to 5 reps, lower reps, higher sets. And I'm boom. The cues are fast, explosive, crisp, moving as quickly as we can with intent. Then after that is when you're going to want to get into any like strength or force development work. So let's make this more practical. So maybe we do, maybe my like A1 exercise in the weight room is a rear foot elevated split squat with like 50% of my one rep max. And I'm doing 3 reps per leg, boom, as quick as I can. And then one thing that works here really well too is to do like a complex or superset it with a jump. So we might do that exercise, and then I may have them immediately go into split squat jumps. So, and you could even do the assisted method if you really want to drive rate of force development. Again, the specifics of all this stuff are going to depend on that athlete, where they're at in their rehab protocol, and kind of your assessment of them. From there, my B1 or B2 movements are going to be probably more strength dependent at this point. So maybe now we're going to do a trap bar deadlift or a single leg deadlift, whatever movement it is that you're doing. But it might be slightly higher reps, slightly fewer sets, and more of an element on loading this up. How much weight can I handle? At this point, if I have like 5-10 minutes at the end, so again, 10 minutes warm up, 15-20 minutes for the speed work. That first block should take about 10 minutes, and I'm at 40 minutes. The next block should take about 10 minutes as well, 50 minutes. I might use that last like 5-10 minutes for more like kind of bodybuilding style work, something where, or you could think of it, if you don't want to use that term, I know it makes a lot of people angry, endurance, muscular endurance. So higher reps, like, and now I'm thinking only like 1 to 3 sets, but I want those repetitions to be maybe 10 to even upwards of 30 reps. So if you still, like, if you're still trying to get some like quad strength or hypertrophy, this is a good place to do something that's really like low skill, really high reps, and just like basically force some blood into that tissue and really drive it. So warm up, speed work, power work, strength work, endurance work would be kind of the sequence that you want to go there.
Yeah, there's so much intent behind everything you just said in regards to the order behind that. Like, you don't want to fatigue someone out. Like, you don't want to do this, all this conditioning, then you get them super fatigued, they're not able to move fast, or you don't want to lift up too much heavy weight before you do this fast stuff, because you're not going to be able to move it fast, because really the adaptations that we want them to get moving faster.
So, boom. Boom. Knowledge bomb. Exactly. But no, seriously, like, I think how you just like explained that is exactly how people need to be thinking. Like, all this, this stuff is pretty, it's fairly simple, right? In the sense that if you think logically about it, okay, why am I, and I think this is something where sometimes you get in trouble. It's like, be clear in your intent of why you're doing something. I think most of the time when people have a lot of questions about like, should I do it fast? Should I do it slow? Should I do it light? Should I do it heavy? How many should I do? It's because they're not clear on why they're doing it. Because for you, like you just said, like, okay, I'm doing this movement to improve rate of force development. Right away, that tells you, okay, I don't want there to be a lot of fatigue, and I don't want the weight to be super high. Because you have a clear intention, the means you're going to use to execute that are very simple. So I think that's a really good point you just brought up, Liam. Like when you're writing these programs, one little tip that like when I was doing strength and conditioning, one thing I would teach all our interns and things like that is like, do not write specific exercises. When you write a training program, you should not start by writing, okay, barbell back squat here. Write the movement pattern, or even better than the movement pattern, lay out the template that I kind of walk through in terms of the qualities you want to address. Then maybe put in the movement patterns, then put the specific movements themselves. And that will, as a coach or as a physio, that's going to really, really help you to be clear with your intent of why you're doing this. And once you're clear with that, everything else becomes a lot more simple.
Dude, that's so huge, because I know I've been in the same mindset too. Like, okay, you get this patient coming in here, you think of, okay, man, these are some cool exercises, I really want to bring them through, I feel like they're helpful, they're big, mm-hmm. They're going to help build more quad strength, things like that. But take a step back, what do you even want that day, what do you want that patient to get out of that day? But maybe even take another step back, and you can even get into a little more like periodization, like, okay, what do I want to get out of this month with this patient?
Yeah,
what do we want to get out of this month, maybe 2 months?
Great point.
And then just keep taking those steps back, it's really going to help, you know, organize the whole process.
Yeah. And I think, like, if you guys are listening to this and you're thinking, like, well, I'm going to get like 15, maybe 30 minutes with the patient, like, you guys are talking about all this stuff, it requires all this equipment. Like, the key is to do, you got like, you have to do the best you can with what you have, with where you're at, right? So I'm laying out kind of more optimal scenarios. And we, Liam and myself, like, we don't always have necessarily an optimal scenario. So that's where I just laid out a session where we might be addressing 5 or 6 different like athletic qualities or movements like that. If you know you're going to get 20 minutes with this athlete, you need to prioritize. So, right? So you need to strike off all that excess fluff, and you need to see what is the lowest hanging fruit here. What is the number one trait that I need to improve with this athlete, and then go all in on that. Okay. So if it's max strength, don't worry about any of that other stuff I just talked about. You're going to train max strength that day, and you're going to spend 20 minutes. And that's where the HEP comes in, especially like with some of the endurance or more like hypertrophy work. That's stuff that most athletes, once you've shown it to them, they can easily go execute that on their own. And I think it's also where you got to be aware of your surroundings and how much like time and access you're going to have for this athlete. If you're going to have them, you know, if you're in a college or pro setting and you're going to have them 5 days a week, like obviously you're going to be able to address more things, right? If you're going to see them once a week, you're going to have to build a really good HEP and do the big blocks in the clinic with you, establish competency there, and then use your HEP to kind of fill in the gaps.
What do you think is a efficient or helpful way to organize the HEP for the patient? Let's say you get this, they're, I don't know, 5 months out, ACL, and you want to make sure that they're on a really good home exercise program. What are you doing to set that up?
So if they're 5 months out ACL, for me, like not knowing the athlete, I would say our my priorities at that point are now like movement skills and probably more power development, potentially strength development, just where they're at. So I'm going to emphasize, I'm going to do that stuff with them in the clinic. So we're going to do their sessions with me are going to be basically like change of direction, agility, like sprinting sessions where we address movement stuff. And we'll probably do some power work. Okay. So maybe some of the lightly loaded weight room stuff where we're moving quickly, and then like really advanced like plyometric stuff. And then I'm going to prescribe them. Hopefully if they're 5 months now and I've been seeing them this whole time, I should feel comfortable with their form for strength exercises. So I'll prescribe them that as part of their HEP. If they have like remaining deficits in, you know, quad hypertrophy or whatever it is, then I'll prescribe them some of that more like endurance hypertrophy work as well as part of their HEP. So we'll work on those two, like the power and movement skill component with me, and then have them do like the strength, more hypertrophy endurance work on their own.
Yeah, I think that's great, because, you know, let's say if you're seeing them, who knows, 2 times a week. Maybe if you hit power hard 2 times a week, maybe that I would think that's plenty throughout the whole week. And if they take care of some other things, the strength component, maybe some speed.
Yeah.
You know, you're covering all bases with that.
For sure. And it gets back to where they're at with their sport practice, right? Because that's one thing that people don't take into account too. I mean, depending on the sport, but if you're a soccer player, those guys are getting a lot of like, they're sprinting, cutting, changing direction, doing a lot of that stuff at practice as well. So,
mm-hmm.
And we can talk about like when they should return and when they should be doing that. But the reality is a lot of times they're back doing that stuff. even while they might still be rehabbing. So in that case, you may be able to not do, if they're practicing soccer 4 or 5 times a week, don't hammer them with more movement skill stuff here. Or maybe it is more just like skill based, but not so much like acquiring volume and exposing them to really high intensities. They may need to really hammer strength work with you in that scenario because they're already getting a lot of movement skill or speed work on the field.
Yeah, I've seen it flip too. When they, you know, we were turning back to working out with the team, and then maybe you just got to, you know, get some other skills at that point in time.
Yeah.
So different ways to organize
that. Did that answer your question?
Yeah. I was also thinking about maybe is the right path to, do you write out a weekly schedule for them? Or do you say, okay, yeah, just what are some ways you think are efficient to organize that for the patient?
This is a hard one, and I don't know that I have like a great answer for this. I try to lay it out in terms of several weeks at a time, so maybe like a 3 or 4 week block, just because I feel like if you determine that there's a deficit in power, you're not going to train. Like, I think 2 sessions a week working on rate of force development is good. And is an appropriate amount to increase that adaptation, but it's going to take a little bit of time. So I would say minimum of like 3 or 4 week quote unquote cycle, where they would do it. So I tend to use some of my like workout card templates from before when I was doing more of the strength and conditioning stuff. So I'll send them home with that. And I like to leave like blanks so they can actually fill in like the resistances that they used. Also it's kind of that, it's like a checklist, right? When they have that, and I'll leave like the, and you know what I'm talking about. You've seen some of the like T3 strength cards, those boxes for them to fill. It's almost like it's like them doing their homework. I like that idea of them like being it versus just like reading something off their phone. They actually have like a paper or Google Doc where they have to type it in or write it in and fill out what they used. Mm-hmm. So I'll do that, and that'll normally have it'll have say 2 or 3 workouts a week for 3 or 4 weeks on that mm-hmm. same sheet. And then I'll have them bring that with them every time they come in, and we'll kind of check it off. And if they have questions or they're like, hey, I didn't know how to do this, blah, 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 whatever, then we'll address it during our time in the clinic.
Yeah, I like that idea of, you know, Blake breaking it up into 3 week blocks. I think it can get so complicated. Well, there's so many unique factors we need to look into that. I love the idea of coming up with that sheet you're talking about where it's kind of, what's the right term for it? If it's got all the different, like A1, B1. Things like that. Just to compare like
it's just organized well. Yeah. Because if you give like one thing too, we just talked about how sometimes there's like a very specific order that you want people to do things based on the qualities you're trying to elicit. Mm-hmm. So if you just give them a random sheet with a bunch of stuff listed, like, I mean, you're just we just threw away everything we said. And again, like, it depends on what they're doing. Like, if you're like, hey, I'm just going to do a bunch of like TKE step downs, like, just you want them to accumulate more like volume for the quad or like just load that up, then yeah, I might not even worry. I might just give them like a circuit. Here's 5 exercises, rip through these 10 to 15 reps, get 3 rounds, do it three days a week. Mm-hmm. And in that case, that's totally fine. But if you're really trying to chase like strength or rate of force development stuff, I think they benefit from having a little bit more structured approach. And not to rant here, but I also think too, one of the like common complaints in physical therapy is patients don't want to exercise, right? Like, they want like the manual therapy. Or people are like how many times has a patient told you like, well, I don't need to come here to do exercise, I can do that on my own. This is something like I feel like really strongly about just because I started kind of more in the exercise world, and that's kind of my first love with this stuff. And I think you and I both agree like there's tremendous value in that exercise, right? What do we call it? Therapeutic exercise. So the type of programming and structuring that we're talking about right here, this isn't like your like garbage HEP printout where you just do this and like, they're not going to do it, whatever, nobody cares, blah, 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 blah. So I think when you, as a therapist, when you approach your programming and prescription for HEP with this level of like, attention to detail and things like that, the patients see that and they also buy into it way more, right? Because if I print off a couple like exercises that everybody knows, right, calf stretch, quad stretch, hamstring stretch, boom, 2 sets of 30 seconds each time, blah, 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 and then I go send them with the tech to do it, no, they're not going to do it, right? Because they're like, well, this isn't even important enough for the therapist to go over with me or focus on with me. So you're sending like a really, you're setting yourself up for failure. If I am very intentional with this stuff. I have the specific card. Like, there's so many good signals there going to the patient. You're basically reinforcing to them over and over and over, like, hey, this is really important and this is a big deal. I need to really focus on this and execute it properly. So I just, that's kind of a little rant, but something I think that we need to consider for sure.
Yeah. Continue to communicate with the patient throughout those, you know, communicate those blocks. Like, okay, this block right now, this is why we're doing this stuff. The more the patient can understand that stuff, you know, just like you said, the more buy-in they'll have, and educating them on what you're talking about, like the exercise order of when you're outside of here. And even when I'm thinking about like different personalities of patients too, I know I've got some patients come to mind when if I give them this many things, do it for this many times, they're going to do that to the T.
Yeah.
But you know, some other people, they're not going to do anything. So am I going to create this huge template for every single person? I'm not going to. But, you know, talking to them, feeling it out, and I feel like it is appropriate for a good amount of athletes.
Yeah. And I think just like for the listener or whoever, so you guys know where we're coming from, like when I'm talking about all this stuff, I'm thinking about the kind of avatar that I have in mind is a high school athlete who wants to play high level like college athletics. Okay. So one thing that I'll do too is if you're having a hard time where they're getting buy-in or they're just like there's too much going on or they're not executing properly, is I'll tie it back to their sport and their goals. Okay, so if you're a high school football player and you tell me you want to go play Pac-12 football, okay, well, that's a very high level of football. You need to have a very high level of attention to detail with your training and all these things, right? So if I have a high school athlete that just, you know, they don't want to play in college, like maybe they're not super competitive in the high school level, like we might not go down this route because ultimately, like, it's not about me, right? It's about the patient and their goals, right? So you got to see what their goals are. But the minute someone tells you they have big goals or big ambitions, like I work with a lot of baseball players, and I had a lot of baseball players that guys that were going to get drafted, right? They're looking to play the sport professionally for their living. If you tell me, like, I want to be a professional in my sport, the way we prepare, rehab, train, eat, whatever for your sport needs to be professional. And the sooner these kids learn that stuff and the sooner they buy into that, the more success they're going to have. That can be – sometimes that's a eye-opening conversation for them. And you got to pick the right people to talk to about that. But if they have big goals, you know, they better have big attention to detail with their rehab as well.
Yeah, exactly. That's huge. Just get them on the same page about what's you know, what it's going to take to get them to that next level.
Yeah, absolutely. Man, I feel like we kind of hopped around a lot, but I feel like there's a lot of good stuff in there. Just some good framework or kind of some things that to be thinking about for sure.
I think you just got me hype about the next podcast. You might have you said something about what we should eat. I wonder if we should delve down something like that down the road, man. That sounds.
Yeah, absolutely. That would be a good topic to get into for sure. It definitely plays a huge role in all this stuff. So. Liam, anything else we want to hit on this before we wrap it up?
No, I just don't really want to be around you anymore, so I think we should shut this off.
I like it. Guys, thanks again for tuning in. We'll be back next week with some more content for you.
Nice.